to stop life. Maybe we needed this to like listen and be in the moment. It's like you said, maybe it's going to make people appreciate not having jobs, you know, because now Venice is so clean that in the canals you can see fish, jellyfish. Rome is so clean with no people walking that like plants and grass are growing out of the cobblestone. There's the pollution is so down. So, you know, maybe this is going to make us stop and think about what has happened.
Welcome to another episode of Gone Workabout, interesting stories from interesting people. Today, we are here with Marsha. And Marsha, what actually is your last name?
Hello, my last name is De Salvatore, if you're Italian, but if you're an English speaker, it's De Salvatore.
Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is so exciting.
It is exciting. And we've also got another special guest, my girlfriend, Hannah.
Yay!
Welcome, Hannah.
She's one of my oldest and dearest friends from Rome.
Yeah, we go back a long way, Marsha and I.
Yes.
Longer than I'd care to say, perhaps.
Yeah, not at our age.
We don't need to establish dates.
Yeah. Exactly. And age, exactly.
And age, yeah.
So, thank you for coming on the show. Yeah. And I figured we'd start off with a bit about you and then get into the current theme for everybody, which is life during lockdown and what it's like being in Roma during lockdown. So kick us off. How did an American accent end up in Rome feeling Italian?
All right. Well, I am originally from Cincinnati. Again, Cincinnati, if you're American, if you're Italian, it's Cincinnati. But both parents are Calabrian, which is the southern tip of Italy. They immigrated to the States in the 70s. I was born and raised in Cincinnati. And we traveled every year because my dad, like nothing existed outside of his hometown. Like my parents have never been to New York, have only been to like Disneyland and Washington because my dad was like, it's not a vacation if it's not in my country. So, yeah. So every year we would go to Calabria. And so, you know, I also had this big, you know, impact of being around my family and Italian tradition. But then, you know, then there were years that I kind of really wasn't into the Italian thing. It was too much. Once I went away and went to university and I kind of hated that part of my life. I was like, oh, they're so annoying. The Italians, all they do is eat and yell and, you know, smother you. And my mother calls me like 20 times a day. And the first thing she says, did you eat? But did you eat meat? You got to have the protein. So, so I hated this.
Just like the TV, right?
Yes. And then after I graduated university, I just was not into the corporate finding a job. And I really wanted to travel. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm kind of Italian. I could maybe go to Italy. And I really was going to go to Italy for a short amount of time because my main objective, I wanted to go to the UK. I was in love with London and music and fashion and blah, blah, blah. So I thought, well, Italy is in Europe, which is near the UK. So I came to Italy to learn Italian and thought then to go off to the UK. But I just fell in love with Italy. I felt really at home because when I was in America, I felt like a foreigner. And then I come here and I feel like a foreigner, but things make sense because I grew up in this household of like food, tradition, family, even a little bit religion, you know, Catholicism and stuff. And things just made sense. And so 20 years later, man, I've been living in Italy. So that's kind of like my story of how I got here.
Fair enough. And I identify with a bit of that because although I grew up in New Zealand, when I got to England, I was like, well, this is familiar.
Yeah.
I know a lot of this
stuff. You're a foreigner and then you go back and you're kind of really English now. And so you're a foreigner now when you go home and you're a foreigner.
Just hang on a second. I don't know if I'm ready to be English.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Fair enough. I'm not sure I am either, to be honest.
We're all children of the world, right?
No, I don't have much choice.
So much cooler to be a New Zealand, a Kiwi.
Right.
With that
accent. No one's got an issue with that. No one's got a bad word to say.
No. God, everyone talks about the Mecca. Anyway.
And tell us about how comedy features in your life and where that came from.
Good. A little background story of how I, let's say, you know, really utilize my comedies. I was born with a blood disease. I have to have regular blood transfusions. I won't get into the scientific reason because that's boring. And as a child, going to basically my second home was a hospital. My family was nurses and doctors and not the funnest experience, but I noticed that when my dad or my uncle would come to visit me when I was having treatment, they had a different approach. My mom was like the caretaker, you know, would give me like chocolate and take me shopping after my treatment. Like she was like the mother figure that you want when you, you know, when you're sick. My dad, however, my uncle who would come sometimes, would come and do like comedy routines. They would like joke, make fun of the nurses. They would like trip over. They would act like clowns. And I would crack up. And in that moment, I remember even as a child, like, and I'm talking young, I remember I was like, I feel normal when I'm laughing. Like the fact that I'm like, have a needle in my arm and my life is different than other kids, I'm laughing and it felt so good. And so later in life, I noticed like my mom would be kind of sad and down when she would be at the hospital with me. She pretended not to be, but I could tell, you know, as children, we're very, very, we do know much more. I mean, we have to give credit to kids. Kids know a lot more than we think. But anyways, I noticed that when she got sad, it made me uncomfortable. And then so I would be funny and she would laugh. And I remember thinking like, I like this. I like this effect. I like that somebody, I can do that to somebody who's feeling down. So that's sort of the beginning of how I feel like comedy has helped me as a person with, you know, with problems kind of overcome the hardships and how much it gives me to do it. Like not only has it made me overcome those obstacles, but how it makes me, I just love people laughing when I say something funny and stuff. And I learned a lot of that. My comedy comes all from my dad. My dad is the best natural comic there is. He will tell you a story and he just knows when the joke needs to come in, how to set up a story, and it's great. So so then later in life, I utilize that now, and I've become a comedian, and I have my, you know, I have an English stand-up show, and then I have one-woman shows, and so now I brought comedy into my life as more than just making, you know, people laugh, but now on a broader scale audience, and so that's how I got to get into comedy.
That's cool.
Yeah.
It's interesting because you know, we've all seen comics on stage and we've all talked about it and thought, wow, that's really cool. And some of us have been pulled up on stage during improv, like me. Ooh. And it's pretty full on when you're up in front of the lights and they say, and then he danced across the stage. And then you look out at that sea of faces and you're just like, why are my arms and legs not moving? And I can't think properly. These people seem like they're in fast forward.
Yeah. That improv is a whole nother art form. In fact, I do also comedy therapy work because improv and comedy techniques are things that people can utilize on overcoming insecurities, disabilities, trauma, because the steps in improv are life-changing. If you ever...
Do you want to take us through them?
Yeah. So the first one, so there's five main ones. So the first one is letting go of control. And so, of course, we need that in life, especially for patients, because that's why I wanted to do comedy therapies, to work with patients that have like chronic illness or any kind of illness. You have to like let go of control. We are so controlled in everything that we do in life because we're afraid to let people see our weaknesses or our disabilities. And so giving up that control is like stepping out of your comfort zone. And, you know, and that's the important thing of improv. Like you don't want to the people who are the funniest is because it's completely natural and spontaneous. There's no control in that, right? It's when you try to be funny that it doesn't work. So that's one of the steps. Another step is to say, is to trust, right? So in life, and you know, in a lot of situations, we have to let go again. That term's going to come up a lot, is we have to trust. Like, for example, in improv, you can do a scene with a partner, and it's really important to trust your partner, like it is trusting people in life, your friends, your family, your therapist, your doctor. You have to trust the person. So in improv, when you do a scene, you have to trust your partner, because there could be moments where you completely black out. You're like, I haven't anything to say. You have an audience staring at you and you want to drown and you don't know what to do. But in that moment, you look in your partner's eye and they know. If you are a good improver, they know you're sinking and they will take the lead. So it's kind of, again, letting go and trusting. Another tip, another step of improv is yes and. So, and that's, again, allowing life to unfold. If you're constantly like have phobias and fears and you're like, no, 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 what happens is you're blocking life to evolve, right? If you are yes and, you're letting life continue and you could be discovering new opportunities, etc. So in improv, when you have a scene and your partner says, is starting a story. Hey, you know, I went to the supermarket and I bought tomatoes. As you're the partner of improv, if you say no, you kill the scene and the scene is done. But if you say, oh my God, yes, and you bought bread and cheese and then you met the love of your life or whatever, that's, you know, just silly, not thinking right now. But so that's another tip is, you know, yes and, which can apply to life as well. And then what do we got? Trust, let go. Oh my gosh. I don't know the other two right now. I'm blanking right now. Maybe we'll get back to that. But those are the three most.
And you bought bread. And you met the love of your life.
Yes.
We're saving you. Don't worry. We got you. We got you, Marsh.
That's a pretty solid kit bag for people for life.
Yes. Yes. I think everyone should do an improv class. You guys should, if they're in Brighton.
I would be terrified, honestly. Exactly. I'm full of admiration for stand-up comedians, and especially when they do improv. I just can't think of anything more terrifying, honestly.
Yeah, no.
Because you get immediate feedback or not from your audience, whereas if you're acting or singing, you might not be brilliant, but you don't know that maybe until after the show. But the fact that you know in the moment by whether people are laughing or not and have to continue anyway, even if they're not laughing, is just terrifying to me.
Oh, my God, yes. Oh, wait, I have my notes for I don't know if you're going to edit, but I do have the other two steps very quickly. The other one is to agree to play. So like you said, Hannah's like, well, it's terrifying, but just the fact that you would be interested, like that's the first step in improv, is that agree to just try, right? And that is your opening up yourself to get out of your comfort zone to then go let go of control and yes, and. The other one is relax and have fun and listen and be in the moment. So that couldn't be the biggest tip in the world. You know, I suffer from anxiety and sometimes panic attacks. And one of the biggest things in cognitive behavior therapy is listen and be in the moment. That is the most fundamental, I think, philosophy of life. And so, and that's all in improv, because that's what you do in a scene, is you got to listen, be present, and you will have naturally be funny.
So what does that actually mean?
So
in a CBT sense, what does be in the moment and listen really actually mean?
Well, when I was going through a hard time with anxiety and panic, my therapist says, okay, in your day, at least 10 times a day, stop and ask yourself, what do you feel? What do you hear? What do you see? So that seems so like banal. You're like, oh, whatever. But it's true because you're stopping yourself, looking around and feeling. That's what you're doing. Because we are so caught up in our lives and our phones and technology and people and work, the constant stimulus that we don't even as people, okay, and everybody has a different degree. I mean, I'm super anxious. So you do not feel. And that's what listen and be in the moment are those three things. What do you feel? What do you see? And what do you hear? And in improv, that you have to be quick, unfortunately. But in a scene, you have to listen to what your partner's doing and be completely present. If you're in your head, you're not going to respond and you're going to kill the scene. And that's what applies to life. So that's, yeah, those are a little therapy.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so have you had the privilege to work with people and help people with comedy?
I've done a few medical conferences doing the comedy workshop. I wanted to do it more in schools because that's, I think, the biggest, I think it would help so much with high school kids because they've got so much going on. But I haven't been able to push that. In Italy, it's really tough. I mean, it's tough anywhere if you have an art project. I mean, as Hannah knows. But it's not easy. But yeah, I wanted to try to get, I sent out to a whole bunch of high schools in Italy and yeah, they didn't seem too interested. But I'm going to continue because I believe.
Yeah, good for you. Good for you. And unfortunately, all those schools are closed right now, right?
Now, so anything that we have that we would like to do is not going to happen until 2021.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing. So tell us what, I mean, everybody hears about Italy in the media. Yeah. You know, it's almost as if COVID started in Italy, right? In terms of the amount in the news. Of course it didn't, but that's where people really heard about it, right?
Well, that's, I think for anybody in Europe, that's when it got real. It suddenly felt really
yes,
real, like, close on our doorstep.
So what was it like being there? Like step by step, what happened?
Okay, step by step is in February, they started having cases in the north of Italy, this weird Chinese virus from Wuhan. There were all kinds of videos of people eating bats in China. And they're like, oh, the Italians, of course, as racist as they sometimes can be, are like, look at what the Chinese have brought, this virus, because people eat bats. So it didn't seem real. And then every day there was a little bit more cases and always in the north of Italy, to the point that the end of February, it really was getting, you know, to be a problem in the north. But being in Rome, we were like, yeah, I think the Italians are exaggerated. My mom was supposed to come visit me. She's now retired in the south of Italy. And she was going to come visit me. I had a comedy show. I was like, you know, comedy. She's like, I don't know. Everybody tell me this virus is very dangerous. So I was like, please do not fall in this, you know, it's just crap that we're being fed that this is a real problem. And so she did come. And most of the comics in the show, we made fun of this virus. It was February 28th, I think. And so then another week goes by. And again, we're like, whatever, you know, friends were starting to say, oh, we're not going to come out. It's kind of dangerous. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And then a Saturday night, March 7th, I just was watching the news and you're starting to hear like, oh, you know, it's getting really bad in the north. A lot of people are dying, blah, blah, blah. And then it said that the northern people who are originally from the south of Italy fled the north because they had heard that they were going to be quarantined another month or so. So there was this image of people fleeing the scene, like Milan's train station, airport, buses. Someone took a taxi from Milan 4 hours to Rome because there was no way for her to get to Rome. So all these people from the south, or sorry, yeah, originally from the south who are living in the north or visiting fled the scene. And I remember going to bed going, this is not good. It was like a war scene. And at that point, I'm like, I think that the shit has hit the fan. This is serious and real. And then 2 days later, so I made my boyfriend come the next day. I'm like, you are going to come here because I'm freaked out now. And then Monday, we were locked down. And the first 2 days was like an easy lockdown. Like, yeah, everything's open. You can kind of hang out, but kind of not. And so I remember going to the park going, oh, this is kind of fun. And everyone was out, picnic, barbecues, Italians were making out. Like, I was like, is there really a virus and we're in quarantine? And then 2 days after that, so that was March 9th to March 11th, the president was like, yeah, we're completely locked down. Like, everything is shut.
And then, so what does completely lockdown mean? Because I think it's different in every country.
Yeah. Right? So lockdown here means you cannot leave your house unless it's for a medical reason, pharmacy, supermarket, paying a bill. Like, that's absolutely necessary. There are police blocks every major street in Rome. They'll stop you and ask you why you're out. And you have to go around with a certificate saying, like, you know, I consent to being out and am aware that there is a virus pandemic situation, and you have to sign it and they have to check it.
So you have to walk around with a disclaimer.
Yes, exactly. A disclaimer. Bravo. That's the word, disclaimer. Unless you go to the supermarket, no. But if you're like, so you're allowed to walk, but only 200 meters from your home, which is ridiculous. That's like 5 minutes. So yeah, that's basically a quarantine. I have been stopped. My boyfriend drove me to the hospital for my treatment. We always get stopped, but they're really cool. They don't even ask for the disclaimer. They're like, you know, where are you going? I'm like, I'm having a blood transfusion. They're like, oh yes, go. So that's for that reason. They've been great. And then I've seen them from afar stop old people who are not wearing masks. They're like, you should be wearing, they were really nice about it. They're like, you shouldn't be hanging out on the bench. And if you do, absolutely, you need to wear a mask. So I thought that was nice. So that's what the quarantine is in Italy. But starting on Monday, we are going to be able to go out with family members or our partner, and we can walk freely, which I'm a little bit scared because we're going to peak again, I'm sure. I'm sure this is going to spread even more. But yeah, so that's what the quarantine is in Italy. What do I think of? So what happened in the north is, you know, in the beginning was absolutely, I just never have thought we would ever live through something like this. It's the so devastating, people dying alone, not being able to see their loved ones, isolating. It's so lonely. The solitude is crazy. You know, a town like Bergamo is probably the size of Brighton. And I think they don't even have a population that's living now.
Whoa.
I don't know cases, but Bergamo is small. And the death rate, we can Google that. Like, it's insane. A small town, they just got hit. They got hit in the nerve. All the old people in that town are dead. Wow. Because it hit in the nursing home somehow, and they just wiped out completely, like, nursing homes. Not to mention, like, Brescia, Milano. Yes, it's bad in other towns, but Bergamo, it was just, there was this scene with the military had to help carry the coffins because there were so many, and they don't know where to bury them. Like, it's just, it's surreal that this is happening. It's surreal. Now it's much better. But in the beginning, guys, it was, I had to stop watching the news. One night I had a panic attack. It was so overwhelming, overwhelming.
Yeah. And so what's been happening in the last week or so? The death toll's been dropping.
Yeah, it's been dropping. So we had our peak a few weeks ago, and now it's dropping. So that's why they're letting us being a little bit free. So yeah, thanks God. They're discovering more about it. I mean, I think it's inevitable. We are all going to get this virus if we haven't had it already. But, you know, we're going to want it when it's like, you know, with more hospital, with more beds, more staff. They're prepared, and, you know, they're discovering a lot of stuff about the virus. They're discovering that you can get plasma from somebody that has it, who has antibodies, and you can give it to a sick person and they're fine. I'm sure a vaccine will happen in a year. You know, I just think that things will be better if we hit, you know, again, another time of crisis. They're going to know more about it. But up until...
Do you think it's changing people's opinions to the health service?
So, wait, so the different opinions of the health service, like...
Yeah, do you think it's... Because I kind of get the feeling in England, for example, that hospitals, like a lot of the Western world, have just been underfunded and the funding's been quietly cut and cut and cut over time.
That's the problem.
And then we've had this Holocaust moment in terms of the hospital's perspective, and suddenly they're heroes and they're being worked double time and lots of them are dying. And people are suddenly realizing that actually to run a healthy, happy society, maybe we need a medical service.
Exactly. Oh my God. So I'm someone that lives and breathes the healthcare system. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, I only know from what I go to my clinic. But here's the problem. So this is what I'm living now with my illness. My clinic got quarantined after a week in. So what happened was I went for treatment on March 9th. We had to be masked, gloved. You know, my doctors were like, you are not working anymore. You are, you know, you're at high risk. You know, because I have a chronic illness. If something like this, I get this, I might not be able to fight it like a healthy person. So again, all right, that's fine, whatever. 3 days later, my doctor calls and she's like, oh, well, somebody's going to call you to see if you have symptoms. And I'm like, what? No, don't be alert. Don't be scared. It's just that we've had some positive cases on our floor, not only in our ward, but she didn't tell me that. And so you could have been exposed March 9th. And so, of course, I get this and I'm like in sheer hell. So all of us patients now, there's about 200 of us. We have to now go to another, we have to go to another hematology ward in the hospital. And unfortunately, they can only have six people at a time because of the room and because of this, the distancing. So six people at a time for patients that we don't all go at the same time, all 200, but in about 1 day, my clinic can do 20, 25 treatments. So we're down to six. So we go, and so I had to wait 7 days for my treatment because obviously they're going to get backed up having only six patients at a time. So I'm on my last breath, which is not good because my counts are dropping. You know, exposure to the illness, to this virus would be deadly. Anyways, so that was scary in itself. Not to mention that now everything's back to normal. The doctors and nurses that didn't get the virus are back at work. We're still in this clinic, but they're allowing up to 10 to 12 patients at a time. But the doctors, I asked my doctor yesterday, I'm like, how's it going? She's like, it's a nightmare. She's like, you guys should not be walking in the same entrance as other people. But because of the cuts in the budget, low staff, they can't make another entrance. We're at a higher risk because of this. So back to the question of like, nobody wants to, you know, put money in the NHS and it's suffering. And that's what has happened with the virus, not to mention on my experience, which is very small, but that's what happened in the north of Italy. They didn't have enough staff. They didn't know what was going on. They didn't have enough masks. They were treating patients without proper equipment. And so there you go. And now all their heroes. Oh, wow. They're overworked. They're about, can you imagine the trauma they're going to have after this is over? They're going to have to.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I know for a fact from surgeons that I know that some of these people, they're heroes. Totally agree. But what about their families and what about their choices?
Exactly.
They don't actually have a choice. And what I'm hearing is that if they don't turn up to work, then it's understood that they will be sacked.
Yeah.
And what happens if they've got someone at risk at home? Don't matter. Go to work.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of things in the media, isn't there, around don't call me a hero. just fund the health service.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. They don't, my staff that was quarantined, only the people that had the major symptoms got, it was a nurse and a secretary. No, two nurses and a secretary in my ward that got it. They were positive and they had the test. But the other people who were exposed to them all day, every day, didn't even, they don't, they're not enough tests to test this virus. So you don't even know if these doctors and nurses are carrying the virus and exposing even more people.
Yeah.
It's tragic. Yeah. It's a tragic situation. But we can talk about America. They're doing such a great job.
Go on.
Oh my God.
We got a call with a friend in America in the next few days. So it'll be really interesting to get it direct from her. But I also love to hear it from you.
Yeah, what part of America are they?
That's a good question. I think it's the north.
Oh, okay.
But you know, but it's a big place. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know much. It's like a continent.
I think Americans, we all have shitty presidents. But he is, I mean, did you hear his latest is that he would like to test people ingesting disinfectants because the disinfectants kills the virus in 1 minute.
Yeah, we heard, we saw.
Yeah.
You couldn't make it up, could you?
No. Probably drinking bleach would help as well, but I wouldn't recommend that.
No. He doesn't even know. Like, first of all, they have so many misinformation. They were like, oh, it's COVID-19, which means there are 18 other viruses like it. No, there's not. It's COVID-19 because that's the year, you stupid. But, you know, basically Fox News, you know, I don't get.
I started by the good man, Rupert Murdoch himself in Australia, right?
Yes, I know.
He's hated at home and he's hated abroad.
It's so funny. So I suggest that you watch on Amazon Prime Bombshell because they talk about all the women that were accosted by, what's his name? The first owner of Fox TV. But that talks a lot about how Fox Television, Murdoch, I didn't really know his story, but it's very interesting. It has Charlie Theron, whatever, but it's a great movie. It talks about Fox News is awful and it fuels. And that's why Trump is still popular because you would think like, oh, you know, Trump is doing a crappy job. People would know that. No, Trump supporters watch Fox News. Fox News gives fake news that feeds into people who like him and believe that what he says is correct. And so he will continue. He probably will be reelected. And there you go. I just wish he would get the coronavirus like Boris did. But
I don't know if that's helped though, Marsha, because it's actually
martyred him.
Yeah, now the right wing, no. Like literally on the days that we had like the worst death toll in the world, or maybe the second worst after the States, I'm not sure, we had about 1,000 people dying a day. And those right wing newspapers that are our equivalent of Fox News, basically the tabloid press, were not even mentioning the death toll and had big pictures of Boris coming out of quarantine, basically making out that he was a hero. Like, you know, well done, you've taken one for the team. And that has become, unfortunately, that kind of became the emphasis then.
God, that's just, all right, wait a second, I'm just looking. So, hold on. How many people have died in 15,000 April 4th? Okay, no, I don't know. I was looking at the death numbers for you, but in Italy. I can't believe that's happened. How annoying. Yeah.
I'd also suggest to folks that are listening that are thinking, maybe I'd like to learn more about that, to watch the documentary on Netflix, The Big Hack.
Yes, I watched that. That was very interesting.
Right. Right. But let's move on to something a little bit warmer.
Yeah.
Let's talk about comedy during lockdown and your Facebook Live daily update.
Yeah, so it's kind of sad, but kind of fun. So, you know, it's sad because you're doing shows, at home with no audience, because the best part of doing comedy is the audience, yeah, because you feed off their energy and their, you know, heckling and whatnot. But unfortunately, it's not, we're not going to have a show probably until next year. Like, and if we did, it'd be like five people in the audience, completely spread out. So it is exciting because we do have technology, which is allowing us to make videos, stream, go live on Facebook. And it's exciting because it is, it's very global this way. So that's the exciting part, because I'm finding that what, so I make daily update videos about what I'm doing, and I throw in some stand up and kind of lift the spirits during this quarantine. And I'm noticing people from like other parts of the world, from Australia to England, America, Canada, Italy, Spain, Germany, just all these different, Thailand, are watching me. And it's exciting because I can reach a bigger market. So it is kind of exciting. I don't like sometimes when I'm just sitting by myself on my terrace and telling a funny joke and I've got nobody to laugh at with, whatever. And
a little bit like talking to yourself, right?
Yes, yeah. I don't like it. And I've done now two shows where I was a guest, and it's not so bad because you have the comments that come up. So you can feed off of that. So now I'm trying to learn, because I would like to do my normal show, Rome Comedy Club, sometime, maybe hopefully next week, if I can understand. The problem with all this is I suck at technology. I have no patience, and I do things in nanoseconds, and that's not what you can do with technology. And Hannah knows me very well. Ever you have the chance, have Hannah show you the beautiful drawing she made of me.
Oh yeah,
you still have that?
Doing a million things at once, yes. Multitasking on the phone, putting a wash on, sorting some clothes, making some food, all at the same time.
I think I might have seen.
Amazing!
That. Oh my god, it's the best depiction of me. It's so great. That's one of our biggest fights. Me and my boyfriend. Just now, we had a fight because Wednesday is cleaning day. We share chores. I have a house, two bedrooms, one bathroom, one kitchen, and a corridor. And so because he's so freaking slow, I was like, all right, you clean on Wednesday just the living room, and I will clean the other three rooms and the corridor. So I do this in about 2 hours in the morning. But he said in the beginning, no, I don't clean in the morning. I want to clean at 5 o'clock. Okay. So all the cleaning products are on display all day by the living room for him to decide to clean. So
like a wall of guilt.
That's what I do. I barricade the door with the broom, the mop, and all the cleaning products to remind him to do this. And who knows, maybe he'll do it early and we're done for the day. No, he waits till 5. And then it takes him 2 hours. I'm going to repeat, 2 hours for a room that is maybe 5-10 meters square. I don't know what that is, but it's small. What does he do? He dusts, and then he washes the floor one time, and then he plays on the computer. Then he washes it a second time, and then he plays a new tune on his tambourine. And then that takes us up to 1 hour and 10 minutes. Then he gets up and he'll move one piece of furniture at a time. So today it was like 6:40, and I'm like, are you done? He was like, yeah, I'm about done. I'm like, it has taken you 1 hour and 40 fucking minutes. How is that possible? I do not understand. And so we had this fight that I break his balls and he does things on his own fucking time. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to have to check you off the bat. I'm like, you know, either COVID has to attack this fucking house, I'm going to throw you off this goddamn balcony.
Awesome.
The challenges of being together during COVID. No, I'm sure it's really hard to be alone as well.
It's so funny because I'm with someone who is the polar opposite, but I like that because we balance each other out. But sometimes it's like, he literally is like, just, he literally moves a table at, like, do you know a sloth? At the pace of a sloth. I'm like, I could have done this in 2 minutes, washed my hair, redone my entire room, written a play, done a comedy show, do a podcast with you, and cook dinner.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what? I've seen sloths, and
they are cute.
And they seem pretty happy, right?
Yeah, he's so happy. He's in a dream state. He's so happy in this quarantine. He's just like, are we in quarantine? He loves to be home. As long as he has his, like, tambourine, because he plays the bongos and shit. As long as he has, like, something to bang his hands on, he's all good. He's like, what day is it? I'm like, it's been 2 months. You need to get out of the house.
Hey, when you say bongos and tambourines, it reminds me of the music on the street. Tell us about that.
The music on the street, like,
yeah, do you remember during,
when people were singing from their balconies? I think it was quite early on in the quarantine.
It was so funny how people lose steam. So the first, like, week and a half, people are like, "Yes, singing!" And oh, we were having aperitivo on the terrace. We felt united. I was talking to all my neighbors. We're singing. He's playing the bongos. We're having vino on the terrace. And then about a week and a half, it just, every day was like one window less, to the point that it was like, I ain't fucking doing this. And all the windows shut. People are inside. They're like, fuck off. This virus ain't going away. This is tragic. Fuck all of you. So yeah, they stopped playing. Then there was also the clap. So at 12 o'clock, they would clap their hands to respect the doctors and nurses. Yet again, after about 3 days, they're like, ah, fuck it.
Did they do it every day then?
I think that lasted maybe 2-3 days.
Yeah. Right. We're doing it once a week, every single week on a Thursday at 8 o'clock in the evening.
And initially it was like, wow, I've never seen England so united. It's like being in a Latino country or something, right?
Yeah.
This is great. It's bringing people together and it's for a good cause. But then the second and the third and the fourth, it started to ring a bit empty for me because of stories of healthcare workers who've really, they're really doing it tough. And they're not, yeah, like you said, right? They're not being supplied with the equipment they should have, and that's just criminal.
Yeah, so they're basically saying, you know, don't clap for us, just remember this next time you go to vote.
Yes, exactly.
Do you reckon it's going to change the political situation in Italy, or as a good Italian friend would say, the 2000 year decline?
Yeah. I don't know, I've given up on politics. I feel like I have to say, I really like our Presidente del Consiglio. I like Conte. I think he's done a really good job with this. I mean, a lot of people are complaining that, yes, there's probably a lot that can be done with, because we're going to have a huge economic crisis. I mean, I have, anybody in tourism is dead for the next year and a half. Yeah. I know most of my friends who have businesses, they've lost their business or bankrupt or whatever. All my tour guide friends. So I don't know how much can be done for them, you know, and that's sad. And I feel like maybe they could do more when things start back up. But at the same time, I think Italy has done a good job. I really respect what has happened. I mean, I applied for my benefits. I got it within a week. I'm applying for rent help. And it was really easy. I don't know if I got it, but, like, I don't know. I'm quite impressed with what happened. But at the same time, as far as politics, I've given up. I just think the right wing has just gone crazy all over the world. They're just taking in the power. It's just, and I don't think it's going to change because of the virus.
Well, you know, I'm a bit more hopeful than that.
I'm glad.
Yeah, I feel like this is bringing us back to what matters, right? People are wanting to move home. They're wanting to be around their family.
True.
You know, I'm hoping that they're not so worried about buying the upgrade in the car. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah.
That's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping that they look around and say, it's not okay for these people to not have jobs and those people to be dying because we don't have the right health equipment and we don't have enough people in the hospital. So people will have to go through one door. And, you know, I'm hoping there's going to be some effects from that. But what about life after lockdown. So if you think this week and then the weeks to come, what's it going to be like for you guys over there in the warm Roman summer?
At the moment, I mean, this is the best time of year, and it's so gorgeous. The light, the sun, because it's not too hot. Apparently, it's going to be a very, very hot summer, so that'll be interesting. When going to the beach with a mask, I don't know how that's going to pan out. So the problem is I would like to answer that question is just that right now, May 4th, we're going to be allowed out walking, and they're going to open all the shops, I think. May 18th, they're going to open restaurants for only takeaway. Then June, hair salons and officially restaurants, but they're going to have spaced tables, a lot of plexiglass and social distancing. So June, it seems that that's going to be, let's say, going to be our new reality for a while. And then I think schools will start in September, they say. So that's it. But the problem is it's going to all depend, because if people start going crazy as of Monday, going out and not respecting that they can only see their family members or partners, it's going to peak again. So I'd like to say that, you know, by June, we should start getting to a new reality, which will be a little bit freer. I'm going to, you know, maybe I'm going to have a picnic with friends and things like that, things that are outdoors and not inside. But it just depends on what's going to happen, because all the other countries in their phase two ended up peaking again.
Really?
Yeah.
And do you know what's interesting is that you just gave us a list of all the things that are going to be happening and the stages that they might happen in. And I realized that we don't have any of that information in the UK. I don't think.
Really?
We're waiting for an announcement.
Well, maybe.
People just don't know. I was talking to some folks at work, and we were talking about, you know, small businesses and loans, and the small business loan scheme has just not been communicated to people, including the banks that are supposed to be lending. Mm-hmm. So you know how you got that loan when you needed it. People here are just really having trouble, you know. They just everybody needs to know this is how this is going to work. But it seems to me that the administrations all across the world have never dreamed that something like this would happen, and they're almost making it up as they go along, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, even our rules, nobody really understands. They are good. Like at night at 7 o'clock, they will, and all the news, they'll explain again what's happening. But nothing's ever clear. Like, because now they're saying they use this word for partners. Like you're allowed to walk with your family members or your congiunti, which congiunti means like lifelong partner. But what does that really mean? What if somebody's been together with their boyfriend or girlfriend for like 3 months, or I'm with my boyfriend 2 years, or what if I hadn't been quarantining with him? Would that mean that we could still see each other? Like, there are a lot of questions. I mean, they communicate a certain amount, but they are also a lot of who knows. So we will see what happens.
When will they open your lovely local park, Marcia, so you can at least go for a walk?
I know. Apparently Monday. Oh, my God. I'm going to leave my house Monday morning and never come back. I'm never going to come back. I'm just going to be walking the streets, even though, as Hannah knows, I'm the queen of I love to sit and walk limited amounts of minutes. But on Monday, I'm literally going to walk to the Colosseum. I just want to – I miss – Rome so much. I miss it so much. The beauty, because those are my park. I miss my park, but I want to see the center of Rome right now, because it's the most beautiful. You've been here, Ollie. I mean, Hannah, this is her home.
It is a beautiful city.
Yeah, I can't wait to. I'm going to walk to the Colosseum and be like, oh, thank you.
It's just crazy to imagine somewhere like that or the Vatican just empty.
You know? I know. But, you know, it's like, I mean, these are. Maybe we needed this to stop life. Maybe we needed this to like listen and be in the moment. It's like you said, maybe it's going to make people appreciate not having jobs, you know, because now Venice is so clean that in the canals you can see fish, dolphins, jellyfish. Rome is so clean with no people walking that like plants and grass are growing out of the cobblestone. There's the pollution is so down. So, you know, maybe this is going to change. It's going to make us stop and think about what has happened. I hope. I have that a little bit of the negative side. I am kind of scared because, you know, we're so used to being scared of people right now, you know, with the being at a distance, and then you're worried, do they have it? Do they not have it? And I'm afraid that we might have that a little bit trauma getting into life. And I don't want to be like that. I love people. People are my lifeline, you know, and I'm so affectionate and I don't want to change who I am, but I've already noticed that, like, if I'm walking on the sidewalk and I see someone kind of close, I'll go into the street.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw a friend on the boardwalk down by the beach yesterday, and he turned around and he said, "Hey," and he literally opened his arms getting ready for a hug. And then a weird, confused expression went over his face and he just sort of stepped back and picked his dash and up. And I was like, yep, this is weird.
I know. Oh.
It's really strange at the moment because we're sort of imagining being able to go back out and maybe see friends, you know, at some point in the future, and all of those everyday things that just seem wonderful now, like just going to the pub for a Sunday roast or going for a walk with some friends or going to the park for a picnic. But at the same time, you try and imagine actually doing some of those things, and it's weird. It's like, well, we would be together but not be able to hug or not be able to touch. Or be kind of feeling paranoid and worried, and would that even be any fun after all? You know, we just won't know until it happens what it's really going to be.
Right. I don't know. I mean, yes, I want to be like Ollie. I just have moments where I don't know. It was good to stop the world for a second and check in. It's just sad that it had to be like a virus that is. You know, my sister-in-law, she got it, and she, you know, my brothers, and she has two kids, and she got the virus. And at the time, she started doing work from home, and so they created an office space in the basement, so the lower level of the house, which is also like a mini apartment. So there's like a kitchen and a bathroom and two bedrooms. And so on the first day of her work at home, she had a really high fever and a cough. And so she called the doctor and they're like, you cannot expose yourself to your kids or your husband. You need to stay in that basement. So she had to call my brother upstairs and be like, I think I might have it. Just lock me downstairs. And that was it. So every day she would call her doctor by FaceTime, and yeah, she started having shortness of breath. She lost taste in food and smell. And so the doctor said, you probably have it, but of course you can't have a test because there are no tests, and she can't go to the hospital or to the doctor. So she spent 10 days by herself in the basement of her home with her children at the window going, Mommy, hi. Oh, and she thought, you know what? It was a nasty, horrible, like, lung issue, like a really bad bronchitis. But she said, that's not even the problem. It's the solitude, the confinement. You know, when you're sick, you crave touch, someone to bring you a tea, tuck you into bed. You know what I mean? And she's alone. And that's just something that that's what I have a hard time with. What a tragic, awful virus. That's all. So, I mean, I hope that, you know, yes, we're going to be stronger and better. I definitely believe that. I believe in humanity, and things are going to be great. And we're going to be laughing about this in a year. But just the tragedy of this virus, that's what I think gets me the worst.
Totally. So just to round things up, and so that nobody hurls themselves off their balcony. What have you learned? I'm joking. What have you learned from this process, and how are you going to change the way that you live your life?
Well, I have definitely learned patience. I have learned to love being at home and cooking and cleaning, which was something I never did before. And I cannot wait to hug and kiss my friends. I'm going to appreciate every trip. I miss the UK. I can't wait to come visit you guys. I think that we're going to have a sort of renaissance period. I think that we're just going to have this reawakening. Once things get going and we can touch and feel, we're just going to be like, brr. So I've just learned like patience and to really appreciate the small things of, you know, a hug with a friend and learn how to, well, now I mean, if you can quarantine with a partner and make it through, then that's probably the partner of your life. So maybe I'll get married.
I tried to bring this up to my boyfriend. Have you discussed this with Raph?
I did.
Have you just proposed on air?
He started to sweat. He was like,
what? Is this before or after you throw him off the balcony?
Yeah, he was off. Yeah, I threw him off the balcony and I said, just say yes to this question.
or you're off.
Yes. Wow. Him and I. Wow. He's so funny. So yeah, I was like, maybe if we can make it through a quarantine. He has a phobia of planes. And I was like, if you can make it through this quarantine, you can get on a freaking plane. Come on. So hopefully we'll get him on a plane. That will be something exciting. And yeah, who knows? Maybe we'll get married. Because I said, if we make it through a quarantine, then we should get married. And then he started to sweat. And then he took a nap.
It was a little bit much.
That's so brilliant. Thank you so much for being on the show. Is there anything that you would like to add as we close up? Any advice for people out there?
Stay home, stay strong. We will all get through together in this. We're going to be even better, and it's going to make us be more appreciative of life and lots of love and bocce from Rome to everyone.
That's awesome. Thank you for tuning in, folks. And this is going to be one of many in the series of lockdown and COVID and sharing the stories of this experience that we're all going through. Thank you for being on the show, Masha.
Thanks for having me. Love you guys. I can't wait to come to Brighton.
Brighton can't wait to have you.
Oh my God. I can't. Sometimes I hear the seagulls here and I have a moment that I think I'm in Brighton and then I'm not. Yeah.